The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Skip the waiting room. TireRack.com now offers convenient mobile tire installation in select areas. Simply shop TireRack.com for your next set of tires, and at checkout, choose Tire Rack Mobile Tire Installation. An expertly trained technician will arrive with your tires and install them on site, at home, at the office, wherever you are. You'll spend less time waiting and more time doing the things you enjoy. TireRack.com, the way tire buying should be.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man who wants the answers, the questions, and the reasons. Here is the captain.
I want it all. It's good to be seen and good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
This week, we are featuring a beer that used to be one of my favorites, so I cannot wait to enjoy this one on a wonderful summer afternoon. I'm talking about Brooklyn Summer Ale by the good, hardworking folks over at Brooklyn Brewery. This is a light-bodied, smooth, clean, and hoppy summer ale, ABV 5%, garage grade 4 3/4 bottle caps out of 5. And how about a cheers to some of our friends? First up, a cheers to Elaine Wu from Rancho Palos Verdes, California.
And a big We Like Your Jib goes out to Anna in Tacoma, Washington.
And here's a cheers to Trond in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And last but certainly not least, we have Skylar Gorski, who should be a helicopter pilot with a name like that. Skylar is in beautiful Denver, Colorado. Everyone we just mentioned, they went to our website, truecrimegarage.com, and helped us out with this week's beer fund. And for that, we thank you.
Yeah, BWERUN, Beer Run. If you're looking for the first 50 episodes of True Crime Garage, you can get those by subscribing on the Apple Podcast app or signing up to our Patreon. So check those out. And that's enough of the business.
All right, everybody, gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime.
This is one of the most brutal murders in the history of this city. Rashawn's gruesome murder will forever trouble a dedicated detective who retired without solving it. And will haunt Rashawn's mother, who's had to live with it every day.
Whoever did this don't realize that it's a half of me that's just completely gone. I can never get back. It can never be restored.
So that morning, he was up. He was getting his clothes ready. He had his little bag with his resume. And, you know, he was a little concerned because he had been out of work. Not that long, but a couple of months. And it bothered him. So I remember when I got to the train station, I called him. And I said, listen, your phone bill, and if you have any other little bills, you know, mommy's here. Mommy's going to help you. I don't want you stressing over the fact that no one has called you back yet from the few interviews that you went on. You will get a job. Until then, mommy got you. And I'll see you later, because he was my Valentine date. Mommy and son was supposed to get together that day and, you know, have lunch and everything.
This is one of the most brutal murders in the history of this city. Rashawn's gruesome murder will forever trouble a dedicated detective who retired without solving it. And will haunt Rashawn's mother, who's had to live with it every day.
Thursday, February 17th, this is back in 2005. At 3 a.m., we have two New York City transit workers who are setting up lights for a subway track cleaning crew. This is when they made what would turn out to be a very grisly discovery. They spot two large black plastic trash bags on the subway tracks near the Nostrand Avenue station, which is located in Brooklyn, New York. Now, according to the NY Daily News, these were blood-soaked bags found near the southbound tracks. So this would be about 450 feet north of the A train platform. The horrified transit workers decided to take a closer look. This is when they discovered a bare foot sticking out of one of the bags. Now, of the find, one of the workers said, quote, "You could tell it was fresh. The blood on the roadbed was still wet." So while it's unclear to the workers exactly what they have found, their feeling at the time is that these bags with the foot have not been there for too long. The Daily News, which is not known for its subtlety, their article goes on to say, quote, "The sight was so sickening that the first worker who saw it started to scream hysterically, then yelling, 'There's a leg, there's a leg.' The other worker told the news outlet, 'At first, I thought someone was under a train,'" which would make sense given the setting. "At first, when you look at it," they said, "it didn't look real. We didn't really know what we were seeing. But then under the bag, they could see a trail of blood. When police get to the scene, they're going to be the ones that are tasked with opening up these bags, looking inside. Inside the bags, the police found blue plastic bags, and then inside of these blue plastic bags, they found human body parts. The report is that they found a torso, an arm, and two legs. And judging by the appearance, this is from a black adult male. The legs had been cut off below the hips. The blue recycling bags were found shoved between the tracks and the tunnel wall. This is near an emergency exit that leads to the street above. The bag with the body parts was split on both sides along the seams because of its heavy load. So the weight of the contents split the bags. The guess here was that the bags were carried, as there were no signs that they had been dragged along the track bed to the location where they are later found.
Obviously, if the bags are dripping blood, you'd see the drag marks because the bags would be dragging the blood behind them.
This is a weird scenario, right? Because here you have a crew that's setting up lighting for future work that is going to be done. And you can picture this setting right away. It's going to be dark down in these tunnels. And it's difficult to try to describe this find, this discovery, because I, like many of us, have never crawled through these subway tunnels. And so I picture this dark area, but here you have the scenario where this crew is out to set up these lights, and the lights probably come into play here. So they're able to view and provide a description of what they find and then call in the police, who can then start to secure the scene and start their investigation. On the subway platform near the northbound tracks, not far from the bag of parts, police found a canvas bag. So this is different from what they've already found. This was a wheeled black and tan tool bag with a rooster emblem on it. So it's got wheels on the bottom. This is one of those roller tool bags. Inside this bag, they find bloody drill bits and some other tools. So, of course, we are going to be testing the blood that's found on these tools.
Right.
We are going to be testing the body parts. Later, the blood on the tools would turn out to be human. That's what the test would provide to us. And we would also learn the results of those tests is that the blood on the tools matches the body parts that were found in those bags, those other bags nearby.
So obviously somebody committed a murder, dismembered the body to try to conceal possibly the identity of the body, but also a way to carry the body out of wherever the crime was committed. And so we got a dumping ground of the body, but we have a dumping ground site of the tools used to dismember the body.
Now let's go to 6 days later. This is Wednesday, February 23rd. Here we have more body parts are found, which of course immediately are going to be suspected to be linked to the others. This time it was a mutilated pelvis found in trash bags among the debris at Rapid Processing Garage Plant on Humboldt Street in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. This is about 5 miles from the location where the first parts were found.
Right.
Then we have more parts that are found the following day. This is more of the pelvis, an arm, and a hand were found on the 24th. They were all doubled up, right? All double bagged in the blue and then black plastic bags. So this is uniform to the first find. Blue bags inside of the black bags. The then police commissioner, his name is Raymond W. Kelly, said everything found all have similar cut marks, adding that investigators believe the cuts are clean, done by someone with medical knowledge, anatomical knowledge, and the ability to do some sort of refined work. We should note that NY Police Commissioner Ray Kelly is the longest serving commissioner in the history of the NYPD and was a colonel in the Marines serving in Vietnam. So, Mr. Kelly, thank you for your service. So what we're working with here, Captain, is if these were, as the police believe to be, all pieces of the same adult male, one has to wonder, how did his body parts get spread around to a few different locations?
Yeah, was that done by the killer? Was it done by some other means?
So we get one report, and this is from the NY Post, that seems to explain what's going on here. And it says that the Rapid Processing Facility served a company that held the contract to collecting trash found along the subway's A line. And the New York Times reported that detectives found Metro cards in the same trash lots as the body parts.
So if I'm picking up what you're putting down, it's possible that all these bags were dumped in the same location, but some of them were moved by a company that was paid to collect the trash around the subway.
Exactly. So they believe the trash came from stations along the A line, but they were not able to determine exactly where along the A line. So it's a 32-mile route, which my information says has 35 stops. So that's a lot of territory to cover. So this would tell us, Captain, that it seems likely that rather than the parts being disposed of in totally different locations, the recycling plant and the subway tracks, they were all dumped at various locations along the A line tracks. And somehow some of them got picked up as trash and sent to the processing facility in Greenpoint, and others did not. So I believe you are spot on with your assessment there. Meanwhile, there was no head and no clothing that was found with any of these remains.
But strange that they left the hands, because that would be an identifier. Some people would say, well, maybe the head wasn't left behind because they didn't want the police to be able to identify the victim. And if they're not able to identify the victim, they're not able to identify people that the victim would have known.
And this type of dismemberment typically would fall into two categories when you're looking at the person responsible. It could either A, point to the depravity of the individual who committed this crime and these crimes, or B, it could be as simple as making a smaller package to later dispose of. having several small packages rather than one large thing to dispose of. And let's not forget, it also could point to absolutely both all wrapped up into one here. The pathologist concluded that the victim was a young adult black male who had died very recently. Whoever cut him into pieces had done so with, quote, surgical precision. It was theorized that each limb had been neatly and sharply severed at the joint and then a chainsaw used to further disassemble the corpse. On the torso, they found some stab wounds. But the cause of death, as far as the pathologist was concerned, and I think even from a layperson's perspective, was unclear. Because absent the head, this is going to leave some question as to the exact cause of death. Police got to start somewhere. So they decide that they're really going to focus in on the clues that would be provided by the dismemberment. So this is a good start. This is a smart place to start.
Well, I think one of the first clues is if there was a chainsaw used and we think that this murder took place with inside the city limits or close to where possibly the body, where the body was dumped, you'd wonder, is there any ear witnesses that heard somebody using a chainsaw in their apartment?
Anybody that does a lot of yard work or landscaping and has familiarity with chainsaws, I tell you, Captain, my chainsaw is louder than any other piece of lawn equipment that I have with a small motor on it.
Right. And it's not like they make a silencer for chainsaws.
No. And in Brooklyn, people were living in close proximity to one another. So I think you're right. Like if our victim was killed very recently, then look, there's no nice, subtle way to say these things. The victim was dismembered recently. If you put this out to the public, you might get an ear witness that will come forward with some information that could really shrink the size, the scope of your investigation and allow you to hone in on something. Now, we've already discussed some of the details regarding this dismemberment. And again, that's where they're going to focus the early stage of the investigation. They're looking for leads here. At this point, they don't even know who their victim is.
Yeah, but they do have the victim's hands, so they would be able to possibly identify them through fingerprints.
So regarding this cut up with some sort of precision, that's what was stated to the public. And also, by the other statement is by somebody who had knowledge of autotomy. So a butcher, maybe could be a doctor, a mobster experienced in hit cleanup and disposal.
Right.
Now, we have reviewed cases that are similar to this with similar methods used at concealing the disposal of remains. In fact, two come to mind, two cases from Kentucky, and unfortunately, those victims have yet to be even identified.
Right, but this is a very rare breed. It takes a very special level of pile of shit person to dismember a body.
Yeah, very few killers go to these lengths. And while I cannot speak to the exact specificity of these cuts and this body, I don't want to limit it to some kind of expert, right? Because frankly, most times it could be some med school dropout.
Or somebody that worked in a butcher shop for a couple weeks.
They didn't have answers to who that doctor or butcher might be, but at least they were able to identify the victim. Very helpful to the investigation for obvious reasons. Here we have the hands, as the captain pointed out, found intact. Fingerprints will provide police with the victim's name and identity. Sadly, the deceased was positively ID'd as being 19-year-old Rashawn Brazell. Police went to the home where records indicated Rashawn lived. Now, he lived with his mother and stepfather in Bushwick. This is in Brooklyn. Rashawn's mother, Desire, told police that indeed, yes, her son was missing. And in fact, Desire filed a missing persons report with the police just days earlier. Rashawn Brazell was born April 15th, 1985. In 2005, he was a young, openly gay man who was in college part-time and working part-time. He's at that age, Captain, where he's hoping to realize his aspirations of being a web designer, fashion designer or singer. He had tried his hand at modeling and worked several retail jobs, but not really finding his thing. Now, he was known as a kind-hearted and rather creative individual. He often designed and sewed his own clothing. The New York Times described him as an energetic, grounded 19-year-old who loved both music and cooking, and he enjoyed going to clubs with his friends. Now, the day in question here is going to be February 14th, 2005.
Old
because
Valentine's
sadly,
day.
This is going to be the day that he goes missing.
Yeah.
He said he's working part-time, but on this day, he leaves the home with resumes that he had prepared and in hand, and he set out to go job hunting. That's what he tells his mother and his stepfather. So on the morning of February 14th, note, this is also Valentine's Day, Rashawn told his mother he was scheduled to meet with his accountant to prepare his taxes and that he had a stack of resumes that were ready to drop off at retail department stores in Manhattan. So he's going to kill two birds with one stone here while he's out on his travels. Afterward, the plan was that he was going to go meet his mom, his mother, Desire Brazell Jones, for lunch at noon. Rashawn, like many New Yorkers, does not have a car. He does not have a vehicle. He right. uses the subway to get around. Rashawn does not show up for this lunch date with mom. His mom calls him, gets no response. This is incredibly way out of character for this young man.
Big red flag.
Rashawn was known as a responsible and reliable individual. And look, he never stood his mom up. You don't stand mom up on Valentine's Day. This is a note to all the sons out there in listener land. Don't stand mom up, especially on Valentine's Day. And Rashawn was not just a good son. He was a great son, and he would never do such a thing. So, of course, this gave everyone great cause for concern. Later, Rashawn's mother told the Daily News, quote, "It didn't make any sense. He lived through his cell phone." Remember, she's trying to get a hold of him for the remainder of the day on his cell phone and gets no response. She begins to feel very uneasy. So when she gets home from her job, she's a social worker. When she gets home at the end of the day, she calls all of her friends that she knew, any friends of his that she knew their phone number. She's calling them, trying to find her son, to no avail. Finally, she calls the police and reported her son missing on the same day, February 14th. Needless to say, it doesn't seem like much happened. This is Brooklyn. A young 19-year-old male went off the grid. Police have other stuff to worry about. He's an adult.
Well, it becomes tough because he has, like you said, he's an adult. He can disappear if he wants to.
Or just be gone for the night.
Right.
But then later, 3 days later, when the parts are found, which later are confirmed by DNA test compared with his mother's DNA, confirming it was the missing young man.
Right.
Now, unfortunately, police have a homicide investigation. Rashawn's family was devastated by this horrific and violent death. His mother, Desire, said in a 2014 interview with Pix 11, "No one deserves to end up being thrown away like they are trash." She told the NY Daily News, "He was someone so loved, he will be so missed." Everyone loved Rashawn. Desire said he was her best friend. Rashawn's friend Jacqueline Perez described him as, quote, "the most upbeat, happy person there was. He'd always wear something that turned your head, and he always wanted to know how everyone was. He was like a brother," Joel Washington, age 20, a friend since kindergarten, said. So now that we have a full picture of what's going on here from February 14th through the 17th, and then even the later days when additional items are found, now we are essentially riding shotgun with detectives, Captain, staying in the moment, watching from afar. What do the police need to figure out, and pronto? This well-liked and loved young man goes missing on February 14th, his body found on February 17th. So we have 2 to 3 days to sort out. By my calculations, we have 63 hours unaccounted for. We need to squeeze that window closed, fill in the blanks and the missing events from that timeline, and figure out when did he truly go missing? What happened to this young man? And how the hell did he get spread out at various locations along the A train tracks by 3 a.m. on Thursday, February 17th? It was almost the perfect crime. Everyone was distracted, their attention elsewhere. Stacks of cold hard cash sitting on the table unguarded. Who wouldn't be tempted to slowly reach their hand out and steal a pile of Monopoly money from the banker? Monopoly is one of those games that can bring out everyone's most devious selves. And Monopoly Go takes that gleeful mischievousness to your phone in a wildly popular twist on the classic game that you can play throughout your day, anywhere, anytime. Collect rent from friends on iconic properties, bankrupt them by pulling a heist on their vault. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with friends to unlock big prizes and try to top the leaderboards. Whether you're helping out your friends or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is an absolute blast. Download it now free on the App Store or Google Play. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Mine's feeling a little drained. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapist at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/garage today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/garage. Have you ever thought about why your wireless bill is so damn expensive? It's all just radio waves. And how much can radio waves really cost? It seems like big wireless all got together and decided $100 a month. Now, thanks to Mint Mobile, you have a choice. For a limited time, all phone plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. So ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited-time deal and get premium wireless for just $15 a month. I love Mint Mobile. They have great quality. They have wonderful service. I love saving money. Put them together, and I'm getting great quality, great service, a wonderful phone plan for only $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
All right, we are back. Cheers, mates. Cheers to you, Colonel.
Cheers to you, Captain. Cheers to the people that paid for the good seats up front. Investigators canvassing Rashawn's neighborhood. They're talking to the neighbors, and they learn that around 7:30 a.m. on February 14th, and if you're paying attention, you already know that this is the morning that Rashawn went missing.
Yeah.
If you're not paying attention, well, you have been warned. On February 14th, police learned that a man an unidentified man buzzed Rashawn's apartment, and Rashawn came down to meet this man. The two walked to the subway at the Gates Avenue station and ascended the stairs to the elevated platform where the trains are accessed.
And as far as we know, he didn't tell his mother that he had plans to meet up with somebody and go job hunting together.
No. And that's what's interesting here, because either this could be a planned companion, if you will, someone to travel with him, or maybe this is just happenstance that Rashawn doesn't know that this person's going to hit the buzzer and then he's going to go down and go, oh, you're leaving too. You're hitting the subway too. Yeah, I'll walk with you.
Right.
So it's a little unclear if this was a planned event. And the thing that's even more troubling is they don't know who this person is. So this person's not easily identifiable to anybody. What they do have is witnesses saying, look, we saw these events take place. The two are seen going to the subway together. Now, after that, they kind of lose track of both of these individuals, Rashawn included.
Right. And we don't have anybody coming forward saying, hey, I went to the subway with Rashawn that day.
Yeah. And then later we get some other witnesses telling police that they saw Rashawn and this unnamed person exiting the subway in Bedford at the Nostrand Avenue station.
But at least if you're law enforcement, you go, okay, well, we don't have a name, but at least we have a description of an individual that was last seen with him.
And this area that we're talking about now, exiting the subway in Bedford at the Nostrand Avenue station, this is where some of the remains would later be found.
Right.
So this is where the trail of eyewitnesses seeing Rashawn and his movements, this is where that trail ends. The parts found in bags in the subway were situated along the A-line tracks between Nostrand Avenue and Franklin Avenue stations. And the tool bag found on the platform with the parts containing tool bits and Rashawn's blood, remember, with the Rooster brand wheeled duffel bag. Here is your break in the case, Captain. Listen to this. They studied this bag. Police and detectives really honed in on this bag.
Right.
They believe that it was very important, and it's a very simple thing. You have a young man, 19 years old. He's living with mom and stepdad. You take a picture of this bag. You take a close-up picture of the Rooster emblem on the bag. You show it to mom and stepdad. You show it to friends of Rashawn's and you say, have you ever seen this bag in his possession? Did he own a bag like this? Did you ever see him carrying or wheeling around a bag like this? If you get no's from everybody, no, 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 you're going to work your investigation with the idea that this bag does not belong to your victim. It has to belong to somebody. It might belong to your killer.
Definitely.
So they study the make of this bag. They want to know all about it. Where was it manufactured? Where was it sold? How could one get a bag like this? What they come up with is that this bag is only one of 15. I'll repeat that. One of 15 that were made. And it sounds to me like these were like prototype type bags. Like they made them to be tested to see if they were durable, if they helped anybody carry out the job, compatible with the work. So from my understanding, it's one of 15 that were made for testing by the Metropolitan Transit Authority. We'll call them the MTA going forward. They made these for the MTA employees back in 2001. Now, the trouble here with the 15 bags that we know that were made for testing is that the trail of the distribution of these bags, it didn't lead the detectives anywhere. So while they were able to figure out where and how they and why they were manufactured, they couldn't really figure out past the Metropolitan Transit Authority who would have got one of these 15 bags.
Right. And like you said, right now, law enforcement goes, okay, we're starting off. We have a dismembered body. We have these trash bags. We have this tool bag. Okay, if we can figure out the victim, okay, now we have the victim. It's going to be easier to track down this tool bag than it will be these trash bags.
Yeah, and the thing you're hoping here, too, trash bags can be very useful to your investigation. But as the captain pointed out, they're not nearly as unique as these 15 bags, rooster bags that were made. The roller toolbox, tool duffel bag.
But yeah, they can't find the distribution of these bags, but it has an identifier. So then when you're talking to other people that might have seen the victim and the killer together, you can go, did one of them have this bag? Or when you're looking for a possible eyewitness of somebody that saw somebody drop these bags off somewhere, again, you might see a lot of people walking with different styles of bags, but one with identifier. It's a good starting point.
It's a great starting point. The problem is it turns out to be a real kick in the pants later, right? Because as a detective, you're looking at this and you're going, okay, I have this rooster tool duffel bag to work from.
It's a real kick in the cock.
It's one of 15. So if I can locate the 15 different individuals that have these, I got a few things in my toolbox here. I'm looking for the person that's missing their roller toolbox. I'm looking for somebody that may have these black and blue trash bags in their possession. We can use cut or tear marks to possibly identify the ones used to dispose of the remains, right, with the remaining roll. Also, keep in mind, your victim's clothing was missing from the scene. So you may find the victim's clothes in the possession of the killer as well, or the victim's blood in their residence. Also, it would be helpful if you locate someone that also owns a chainsaw. So at the beginning of this investigation, you're thinking, okay, we got a major, major lead here. We should be wrapping this thing up in 48, 72 hours.
Right.
Then later you're figuring out, well, beyond the company where we sent these things, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, we don't know who would have had these rooster bags. So you get this real kick in the pants, and then now you got the police are going, well, our very good lead quickly dried up. So on top of that, the other part of your investigation, they weren't able to figure out where Rashawn had actually been killed. It seems like they could not rule out the possibility that Rashawn was slain right there somewhere in the subway where the majority of his body was found.
Right.
Brooklyn North homicide detective Richard Amato said, quote, I believe somebody who had knowledge of the subway system had to be involved in this, end quote. NYPD detective Anthony Baker told America's Most Wanted, quote, the killer or killers knew the layout. These tracks were two flights down, which leads me to believe they had some knowledge of the tracks, because nobody really goes to the unknown to dispose of something like that unless they have been there before, end quote.
Right, because you wouldn't want to put yourself into danger. And it's a whole different thing, because this is a urban atmosphere. I mean, if this happened in a suburban area where you have neighboring fields or woods, that's where the killer is going to go to dispose a body. But here in the city, where do you dispose of a dismembered body? And some hidden, dark, cavernous area by the subway.
And those detectives are spot on, because I bet you if we were in New York City right now, we could quickly round up 100 individuals that would tell us, I've been on the subway system 1,000 times.
Right.
Have you ever decided to get down into the dirty tunnels and run around? I bet you none of those 100 would say that they've ever done that. So I think the detectives are spot on here with their speculation about potential leads and also a bit of the psychology of the killer here. So police searched those tunnels until they were blue in the face. Detective Amato stated, we checked all the rooms in the subway in between stations, and we never found the original crime scene. To be clear, it's not possible that Rashawn's killer slayed him elsewhere, bagged up the parts, and chucked them from a moving train onto the tracks. You see what I mean? What I'm trying to say is
That's not possible.
Right. The killer had to go down to where these bags were found.
It does beg the question. You start wondering if it's one killer or multiple killers.
True. True. But the subway cars, they don't have windows that open up. So it's not like some killers that we've talked about in the past that are driving along country roads and chucking things out the window.
Right.
And the other thing, too, we've hinted at this a lot, but it's Detective Amato. They have every reason to believe that the killer has intimate knowledge of this dark, maze-like, rat-infested tunnels that are the subway system, right? Because this is not something that most people would be comfortable with doing. One, the dismemberment. Two, the going to the location where the body parts are found.
Well, again, and I know we're talking about a dismembered victim, so it's hard to get around having uncomfortable conversations, but his head is missing. And so again, is it a Dahmer situation where you're going to find a suspect and in the refrigerator, you're going to find the severed head?
It's a very difficult case to discuss, and for obvious reasons. The other thing to another difficult part of this case in the investigation is to think about the chilling possibility that Rashawn had been kept alive for some time before he was killed. Remember, we have the statements of the pathologist. He was found on the 17th. The medical examiner determined that the remains were that he was killed recently, and yet he vanished on the 14th.
Yeah. And again, never showed up to eat with his mother, wasn't answering his phone. It makes you wonder, was he captive somewhere? Was he tortured? I mean, the things that his family and friends would have to, what would be going through their mind would be just horrific.
And there's everything telling us, Captain, that he wasn't just alive elsewhere willingly. He would have met mom for lunch, or at the very least called. He would have called mom if he couldn't make it to lunch. So it's really a matter of determining what happened in the interim. Virtually no information about this case has been released by authorities, but we do know that the police believe that the person who killed Rashawn, quite possibly the same man he met on his stoop on that Valentine's Day.
Right.
Everything's telling you, Captain, this has got to be somebody that Rashawn knew. And his mother, Desire, is convinced of this as well. And we know this because she told NY Daily News, quote, "a friend killed him, someone he trusted," end quote. She said at 6'1" tall and 180 pounds, her son was not a weakling who could be easily overcome. And his friend Lamar said the two often went clubbing together and Rashawn could fight when need be.
Right.
So he likely went with this abductor, walking casually together to the subway.
Well, and it makes you also wonder, too. I mean, is this a hate crime based on his race or his sexuality?
That is certainly something to be investigated. And unfortunately, look, we know nowadays one thing that is a fantastic tool in the arsenal of detectives are cell phones. Victims' cell phones. And Rashawn's cell phone would be of great interest to this case, of course. But we don't know much about what the police knew. And it seems like we got mom calling the phone, calling it on the 14th. The phone is going to voicemail at some point. It's believed that it was dead or turned off at some point. It looks like his phone was never recovered. We know the clothing was not recovered.
Right.
Now, one thing we do know, one thing that we did find out is that there was one call, a phone call that was made from Rashawn's phone at 7:25 a.m. on that Monday. Now, investigators have not revealed, will not reveal who the call was to.
Well, because it makes sense. If you're going to meet up with somebody, hey, meet me down, you know, meet me downstairs and we'll head up to the subway together. Or is that call going out or is the call going in?
Exactly. And as said, the phone was never found, but we do know that the It's been reported that the police were reviewing all of Rashawn's telephone records and looking at computers he might have used. One lead that was followed up extensively was a male acquaintance of Rashawn's, who was believed to be someone Rashawn had planned to go and spend a few days with.
Right.
NY Daily News, citing, quote, sources, reported that Rashawn's friends told police that he and a male lover were planning to leave for a few days. This person, it sounds to me like this person has been identified and investigated, but has never been named publicly.
Right.
So it would seem like this is not the killer. This police do not believe that this person is responsible. And it also seems like that this is not the same person that Rashawn met with that morning.
Yeah. And look, I mean, this guy, he was a looker. He was very handsome. He would not have a problem getting a date on Valentine's Day or to get somebody that fancied him to go with them to drop off some resumes.
There was a person of interest early on in this case. This is when police discovered that Rashawn was in some sort of relationship with a slightly older man. This man is in his 30s, or was in his 30s at the time. He was an individual who rented a room in an apartment around the corner from Rashawn's mom's house. This person has never been named publicly, so I'll refer to him as the unnamed man. But interesting to our investigation, it seems like this unnamed man vanished right when Rashawn was killed, or soon thereafter. Police didn't know where this man was, only that they had heard from some individuals that the man may have moved south. Now, a high-ranking police official told the Daily News, quote, "We are not certain if Rashawn ever made it to meet up with this man, but if we can confirm that he did, then this guy is going to be very, very important to their investigation." But quickly, we will learn that that lead really led nowhere.
It also goes against eyewitness accounts. It wasn't that he was seen with an older man leaving the apartment building, going to the subway. Also makes me wonder, too, you would think that there would be some CCTV footage of Rashawn going to the subway or getting off somewhere, getting off a stop picked up by some local business.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, Captain. The thing here is regarding this lead with this other man. So detectives eventually found the man and they determined he was not a good suspect. The thing here is you have this information that Rashawn is walking with another unidentified man to the subway and then later seen with an unidentified man getting off of the subway. So to me, this goes back to like a lot of cases that we've covered. When you're asking the public, hey, we need help identifying the person who he could have been with, where we're looking to talk to the person that he could have been with that morning. When said person doesn't come forward and say, yeah, I was with Rashawn that morning, I would decided to hop a ride on the subway myself.
Right.
When that person doesn't come
very
forward,
fishy.
That person's got to become suspect number one. And I think what police are doing here, yes, while you have that individual that you're looking for, you also have to determine that Rashawn didn't go and meet up with somebody elsewhere later. And when you don't know who that person that is walking with Rashawn, you also have to cover all your bases and make sure who's to say that this other person wasn't killed and still concealed somewhere.
Right. And we just haven't found that body. But then it also makes you wonder if you're law enforcement, did this individual come from the area that they left, right around Rashawn's apartment, or is this individual from the area where they went to?
Yeah. Again, you're trying to squeeze that 63-hour window. And what I really believe looking at this case is that whatever trouble found Rashawn, I believe he was in trouble before he could get to that lunch date with mom. I believe that either happened all around the same time or shortly before, because something prevented him from calling his mother. Something prevented him from going and meeting his mom that day.
And something prevented him from answering her phone calls. I totally agree with you.
Now, police wondered whether Rashawn's tax preparer story may have been a white lie that he told to his mother to explain that he would be gone that morning, because they weren't able to locate any appointment that Rashawn had that morning. So they were wondering if maybe he had something else set up.
Yeah, but some of those places you just walk in.
That's where my head went too. I'm glad you said that, because a lot of times people will either just walk in or they will drop off their information, their file in advance and say, hey, get to this when you can. It's February. We got some time on this.
Right.
I got to drop this off at some point. It's 2005. Here you go. But it would appear that if he had a regular tax preparer, which I don't think we could call anybody regular, he's only 19, that one, they may not have been able to identify anybody that he had talked to. In that regard.
Sometimes you just go to a company and it doesn't matter. I'm getting my tax prepared from Liberty Tax, and whoever happens to be there that day will be the people that will prepare my taxes.
From Jump Street, and you talked about this a little bit earlier, Captain, from Jump Street, and as they went through the early stages of the investigation, the reality was police had no idea why Rashawn was killed. Was it a lover's quarrel? Was it a hate crime because he was openly gay? Was Rashawn tangled up with a bad crowd? The answer to that last question was, it's an absolute no. People who knew him, including his high school principal, said he was a good kid, someone just trying to find his way, that he wasn't some street gang kid or drug dealer who could have been killed by any number of people. He was a threat to no one. One investigator told the NY Times this victim was not leading a criminal lifestyle. They would have found that in their investigation.
I'm just going to reiterate, very handsome kid. And so, yeah, no clear motive of why somebody would want him dead. But you could then say, look, again, could get a date if he wanted to. I'm sure if you're law enforcement, that has to calculate into your investigation to go, there could have been many people. There could have been many people that fancied him. There could have been many people that had a crush on him. And if, hey, it's Valentine's Day, I'm going to make my feelings known. And if he rejected them, I guess that would be a possible motive.
Detective Jason Palomar, who we will talk about and discuss a little more in episode 2, he's now retired, but he worked on this case for years. He told us that there were lots of hopeful leads early on in this investigation. He said they looked at Rashawn's friends, acquaintances, online connections, contact list, and so on. And unfortunately, all turned out to be dead ends. Those potential leads just simply led investigators nowhere.
I have to be honest, in the beginning of my son's case, I did not feel that the detectives in the very beginning was really working my son's case. I have to be honest with that. My son's case didn't really start getting worked until Detective Amato took it over himself. I'll never forget how this detective came to me and he said, you know, the people that I've talked to, no one has had any bad thing to say about your son. You know, when it got called, I decided to do a march, you know, to keep his name out there, to let them know somebody knows something. Whatever you know, I gave my email, you know, I gave numbers that, you know, people can reach out to. I got together with this church and we used to go out on Notion Avenue where he was found on the train tracks there and we would light candles. And, you know, certain news reports would come out and, you know, I would say once again, somebody knows something. whatever little thing that you think is not important, talk about it. Tell somebody about it. I gave gatherings. You know, I sold dinners just, you know, in his name. There was a scholarship fund. It was called the Rashawn Memorial Scholarship Fund that was started with, you know, Larry Lyons and some of his other people. We got together and we were so successful in raising money where we sent other kids to college, you know, with money that was donated. I tried to do everything I possibly could to make sure that his case just didn't go cold and nobody, you know, wasn't working on it. And it was hard for me. It was hard because I knew somebody out there had took my son's life. And the way that they did it, they didn't even allow me to look upon his face again. So with all of that, it just had me charged. I mean, in the beginning, I was so angry. You know, I was hurt. I was so many emotions. I wanted to know why and, you know, how could this have happened? And I even blamed myself for a while because I felt like maybe I led him to believe that, you know, everybody needs help, and because of the work that I do, you know, I wanted my child to feel like, you know, the homeless, the weak, the people that you can help, you can help. Maybe I made a mistake about that, but I just kept going. I just kept going.
I want to thank everybody for joining us here in the garage. For everything true crime, check out truecrimegarage.com. While you're there, sign up on the mailing list. And until tomorrow,
be good, be kind, and don't litter.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.